This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's shutdown day 27. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers are still going unpaid across the United States, and many are finding themselves unable to afford the basics. You're seeing it in your communities.
Hi, I am an active duty member of the Coast Guard.
Jennifer from Drain, Oregon.
Joe in Jersey City, New Jersey.
Carol from Washington.
We defend the coast of the United States.
If the shutdown continues through February, our government subsidies will not be available to us.
We respond to natural disasters, pollution events.
My grandson, who was in the Coast Guard, needed money for groceries. His parents had to send him money.
We risk our lives to save the lives of fishermen, mariners, and recreational boaters.
Gainfully employed federal workers having to line up at a food pantry? This is a disgrace.
Now we can add department store greeter, security guard, babysitter, and more to our resumes as we start to look for ways to meet our financial obligations. And finally, we can say that we take collections from the public to disperse to our own shipmates because there seems to be no end in sight.
But in communities across the country, neighbors are also banding together to provide everything from food to legal services for struggling federal workers.
Took an oath to keep people safe and to do our job. And if we're not going to be there to do it, who is?
Debbie Cherry is a transportation security officer from Phoenix. She's pregnant with twins, has two young children, and on Monday, she went to a mobile food bank that popped up outside of the airport where she works.
Well, it was around 11 in the morning on a winter's day in Phoenix, which is pretty sunny and warm, actually. It got really hot.
That's Casey Kuhn, a senior field correspondent with KJZZ in Phoenix.
You know, everyone was kind of frantically rushing around trying to get all the food packed in. Within an hour, I think they were already more than halfway through, and it was supposed to last for 4 hours. So clearly there was a need there, and it ended up, first people were walking up to the tables to grab their food, but it ended up becoming more of like a drive-through, and then that drive-through was like 20 cars deep. There are more than 900 TSA workers and federal employees that work at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport here in the valley. So St. Mary's Food Bank, which is the largest food bank in Phoenix, was able to create a mobile food pantry, kind of like a one-time food pantry at a site really close to the airport. So TSA officers could come over during their shift, after their shift, or before their shift, or even on an off day to pick up two bags of groceries and milk and eggs.
St. Mary's served 300 TSA workers on that Monday, and more are being served throughout the week.
They said that they've seen an increase of 200 people a day since the government shut down at their regular food bank locations. This was a, like I said, a mobile food pantry, so they brought 25,000 pounds worth of food to this area near the airport. That includes cereal, tinned chicken, it included fruit, bread, peanut butter, jelly, kind of stuff that families would use to make lunches for their kids. And then they also had the perishables like milk and eggs in their refrigerated truck.
And milk and eggs is behind
me. People were nice and made a lot of donations during that time.
Jerry Brown, a spokesman for St. Mary's, told Casey that the food bank does have a stockpile of donations from the holidays, but that stockpile can only last for so long.
This food normally lasts us in the food bank until March or April. We're using a lot of it now.
So they've been asking for cash donations because food donations from an individual don't go as far as cash donations for a food bank.
That need was on full display on Monday outside of Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport.
There were a lot of TSA workers who still had their uniforms on. Some were just getting off their shifts. There was two friends who had met while they were on the job at TSA at Phoenix Sky Harbor, and both of them had two children under 6 years old. One of them was pregnant with twins due in less than 2 months. There was a young 36-year-old Federal Aviation Administration engineer who was looking for other jobs because he hasn't had a paycheck in 3 weeks and has four kids to support. So a lot of families and the age range from the 30s to 60s and 70s year olds.
And many workers are also reluctant to open up about the pressures they're facing.
a lot of the people I talked to actually didn't really want to talk to media because I think it does feel a little bit like hurting your pride to go and take free food. But basically, they're saying that they're having to either dip into their savings to pay for things like the prenatal needs or just food on the table, borrowing from family members, borrowing on interest that they're going to have to repay later. So, I don't think anyone was necessarily preparing to not get paid for 3 weeks. So this is definitely stretching the budgets of most of the people I talk to.
It's just been stressful, kind of. And then when you got kids on top of it, the young kids, it's just been like a ball of anxiety, really.
Gabriella Coleman is a TSA officer at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. And her family, they still feel like they need to go into work, but they don't know if they're going to get back pay, for example. Well, they didn't know if they were or not. And even if someone says they are, they don't necessarily know if that's actually going to happen. Are they going to get paid for the sick days that they had to call off during the shutdown? The longer the shutdown goes on, the more people are worried, the more it stresses themselves and their budgets. So I think that definitely was a stressful time for them.
But Casey says the shutdown also seems to be bringing out the best in some people.
Something that I found really interesting and kind of heartening, at least, was two TSA officers came right off their 8-hour shifts to the food bank to actually pack up food for their colleagues. They said that they're like a family. So it definitely feels like everyone's trying to band together. There was TSA high-level management there handing out eggs to their workers. And actually, the food pantry is doing another one of these mobile one-time food pantries up near a hospital, where other workers have been having to still go into work because they're considered essential federal staff.
A little less than 1,000 miles away from Phoenix, San Antonio, Texas, is also feeling the weight of the government shutdown.
San Antonio is very much a blue-collar, paycheck-to-paycheck kind of town, always has been. We don't have a lot of Fortune 500 companies here, but it's a friendly, well-connected city. I think the median income is about $49,000. It's largely an Hispanic Latino town, but very much blue-collar. So this doesn't help matters when you have more people with bigger paychecks that can't spend any money on the local economy.
Brian Kirkpatrick is a reporter for KSTX in San Antonio. He says that there are all types of federal employees who live and work in the city that are affected by the shutdown.
A lot of it, it's law enforcement. Customs and Border Patrol is a big employer in South Texas. Of course, the TSA. Most of the military bases, anything under the Department of Defense is already funded, so they're not really affected. But, folks that rely on those bases are going to start feeling the pain, too, when those employees aren't spending their money. It's been very interesting. We had the San Antonio Food Bank tell us there's been a trickle of unpaid federal workers seeking food assistance, but not a lot. They do expect more people to ask shortly, and they're asking for donations. There's a local bakery here, Bakery Lorraine. It's offering free breakfast, coffee and pastry for each day of the shutdown for affected government workers. Also, a law firm is offering to do free wills, which is interesting. So it's been all kinds of things. Even the Texas Diaper Bank is collecting diapers on behalf of federal families that need those.
But like Casey Kuhn in Phoenix, Brian says he's also found that many federal employees don't want to talk about what they're going through.
I think there is a right now going on somewhat of embarrassment, maybe a little bit. Also, I think of some of these folks hope they want their jobs back soon. I'm not sure if they're worried that if they say something that might somehow jeopardize their return, or if they've been told to refrain from comment. I'm not sure if there's what the guidelines there are, if any, or that it's just, I think it's strange how many of them are not speaking out more.
The impact of the shutdown isn't limited to the lower 48.
Sitka is on Baranof Island. It's a small island in southeast Alaska.
Catherine Rose is a reporter for KCAW in Sitka.
Here in Sitka, we have about 300 federal employees. That number varies somewhat because of seasonal employment, but we have a large Coast Guard base here in Sitka. Many of those people are furloughed right now. We have a number of Forest Service employees who are on furlough. And so I would say it's the third or fourth biggest employer in our town. people are struggling. You know, it is an expensive town to live in. Sitka's pretty far away from the lower 48. We have to barge in our food, and there's, you know, a price increase with all of that. Food is expensive in Alaska in general, and so rent is going up. Utilities are expensive. Living on an island is costly. So a lot of people do live paycheck to paycheck. That's what we've heard from a lot of people who are affected. They live paycheck to paycheck, and they are feeling the impact of this shutdown very strongly.
And on an Alaskan island that's just 1,600 square miles, there aren't a lot of options when the going gets tough.
We are so isolated. The economic opportunities in Sitka are pretty limited. You know, the Coast Guard is a huge employer. The Forest Service is a huge employer. And people don't have the opportunity to go anywhere else for work. They're looking at substituting at the schools. You know, the school always needs substitutes, supposedly. So, you know, people are trying to find ways to grapple with the shutdown, but because we are so isolated, there's nowhere to drive to find a, you know, part-time job to make it through this time period. I think that's for us, that really heightens the impact of the shutdown, the isolation.
But like in Phoenix and San Antonio, the community in Sitka is stepping up to meet the needs of the federal employees who live there.
The local tribal government, Sitka Tribe of Alaska, they opened up their food bank recently. It's usually only open to tribal citizens, but they opened it up to all furloughed employees. So they're asking for more donations because they know they're going to see an impact there on their food bank stock. Local churches are working directly with the Coast Guard. Local grocery stores, we have two grocery stores in Sitka. There's not a whole lot of competition, but they've both said they'll open up lines of credit to Coast Guard and other federal employees to help them during this time. But businesses are worried that their typical Coast Guard employees aren't going to be there, you know, drinking at their bar tonight or eating, ordering a pizza.
You know, my heart just went out to the families because it's, you know, Sitka's an expensive place to live, and so many people live paycheck to paycheck.
Even with worries about their bottom line, business owners like that person, Edith Johnson, are doing what they can to help people get by.
You know, while they will be getting paid eventually, I mean, it doesn't help with the situation now. They take care of us, so we're going to take care of them.
She is a chef here in Sitka and owns a restaurant, and she serves lunch specials and sandwiches. And she was the first person in Sitka to offer any kind of relief to furloughed employees in December. She said she would give free lunches, free meals to anyone furloughed with an IOU they could pay her back whenever they got paid.
Those shutdown dispatches were from Catherine Rose, a reporter at KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, Brian Kirkpatrick, a reporter with KSTX in San Antonio, Texas, and Casey Kuhn, a senior field correspondent with KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. Our thanks to all of them for sharing the stories of their communities during the shutdown. And we still want to hear your stories from your community. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be part of The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, with print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and banners. More at Staples stores or staples.com.
On Wednesday, a suicide attack in northern Syria killed 19 people, including four Americans, in the city of Minbij. ISIS has taken responsibility. The attack comes 1 month after President Trump first announced that American troops would be pulling out of Syria after having defeated ISIS. Ben Hubbard is the Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times, and he's been following the developments. He joins us now from Beirut. Ben, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So what do we know about this attack in terms of its targets? Was this a targeted attack towards American troops?
Seems very clear that this was definitely targeted towards American troops. This took place in the town of Minbij, which is in northern Syria, fairly close to the border with Turkey. This is an area that is clearly sort of under American protection, and I think where the Americans had felt very comfortable. What we heard from people in the town yesterday is that there was a particular restaurant downtown that they liked to stop at. They would go there and, you know, take breaks when they were doing patrols through town and eat and whatever. And yesterday, while they happened to be there, somebody wearing a explosive vest came in and blew himself up, and that's how this terrible event happened.
The U.S.-led coalition confirmed yesterday that American troops had been killed in this attack. And just an hour later, we heard this statement from Vice President Mike Pence. I'm going to play this for you. Take a listen.
Thanks to the leadership of this Commander-in-Chief and the courage and sacrifice of our armed forces, we're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners, and we are bringing our troops home. The caliphate has crumbled, and ISIS has been defeated.
Ben, you've covered the war in Syria for years. What do you make of the Vice President's remarks?
Well, part of the trick is how you define what it means for the Islamic State to be defeated. The thing that set this organization apart from a lot of the other terrorist organizations that we're familiar with, Al-Qaeda and all the other organizations, is that their goal from the start was to establish a physical territorial entity. They wanted to have a so-called caliphate, you know, this sort of Islamic state that they were going to run, and it was going to have all the trappings of statehood. And so when people in the Trump administration talk about defeating ISIS, they're talking about getting rid of the physical caliphate, like the physical control of territory. And over the last number of years, because of intensive American airstrikes and also assistance from American forces on the ground to local fighters, both in Syria and Iraq, it is true that we've gotten rid of most of the territorial control. There's still some small pockets here and there where fighting is still going on and where, you know, they're trying to get, you know, get them out of this territory. So, you know, on one hand, it is true that the caliphate has largely been defeated. It's mostly gone in terms of being a territorial entity, but that doesn't mean that this organization no longer has the power to carry out attacks and to do, you know, things like this attack that it managed to carry out yesterday.
We know that the vice president was making these remarks, particularly after President Trump made a recent announcement that they would be withdrawing troops from Syria and from the region. Could this attack be the thing that changes his thinking?
It could really go both ways. You definitely had a lot of, you know, a lot of members of Congress and a lot of members of the president's own, you know, Republican Party coming out and saying this just proves that the Islamic State has not been defeated. This proves that we need to stay there so that we can continue to fight them and keep them from coming back in greater power. You know, there are certainly a lot of people who are arguing that the U.S. does need to stay and that this bombing we saw yesterday is one more piece of proof for all the reasons. On the other side, it's not hard to imagine a scenario where people say, wait, what? Minbij? Like, where's that? I've never heard of it. Does it have significant American interests? Are there oil wells there? Is there significant American commerce there? The answer to all those questions is no. So it's not hard to imagine a scenario where you're going to have some people saying, well, why did four Americans get blown up there? What exactly were we fighting for? And how exactly does that relate to, you know, our own security? And so we're just going to have to wait, I think, as the information comes out in the aftermath of this attack and see which way it goes.
Ben, we've seen images of the devastation, particularly how it affects children. Your colleague, Tyler Hicks, has done amazing work around this. But this humanitarian crisis doesn't seem to have an end. What are the sorts of conditions in Rukban right now?
Well, I think we kind of have to start with the larger humanitarian crisis going in Syria. I mean, the conflict that's been going on there since 2011 has displaced about half of Syria's population. I mean, half of the population of Syria has been moved somewhere else. I mean, millions of these people have become refugees outside the country, most of them scattered around the neighboring countries, Lebanon, where I am, Jordan, Turkey. They all have large refugee populations. Obviously, we had, you know, waves of refugees going to Europe on the boats. But the largest number are actually people who are displaced inside of Syria. So they've left one part of the country where there's fighting or there's violence or there's destruction. Then they've gone to another place thinking that either trying to go another place that was safe, or in the case of Rukban, they were trying to get into a neighboring country and the borders got shut. So a lot of the neighboring countries of Syria have, for the most part, shut their borders to new refugees because they feel that they have too many and they don't want to take in any more. So Rukban is a place where tens of thousands of refugees who are hoping to get into Jordan ended up, and it's this very isolated place. It's kind of a desert camp. Conditions there in the best of times are quite miserable. It's been difficult at times for aid organizations to get in there and provide assistance. And then over the last number of weeks in the region here, we've had some pretty exceptional winter weather. There's been huge storms, rainstorms at some of the higher altitudes. We've had snow, and so it's really made life miserable for a lot of the refugees around the region, both in the neighboring countries and inside of Syria. You know, that's the larger context of this report that we had this week from the UN saying that there were 8 children who had died in Rukban. And then they also had reports that there were 7 more children who had died elsewhere in Syria who had been displaced.
The United Nations also reported that 10,000 people have fled violence in Deir Ezzor since December. Ben, those 7 children that died while trying to get out, what was the situation like there?
We don't know very much. I mean, other than that, but this, you know, the conditions for these people, even in the best of times, are very, very dire. I mean, these are people who are leaving oftentimes very quickly. A lot of times people who are displaced in Syria have not just been displaced once, but have been displaced multiple times over the last number of years. So sometimes you'll meet refugee families who have lived in 5, 6, 7, 8 different places. And so, you know, we don't know the specific cases of these families or of these deaths, but, you know, these are very, very dire situations that they're in. And then, you know, when their situation is that tenuous, and then all of a sudden you have incredibly inclement weather come along, whether it's freezing temperatures or serious rain, things like that, you know, then it just makes life that much harder for the most vulnerable, who are going to be the children and the elderly.
Is there concern that the situation could get worse by if the U.S. withdraws its troops?
It's a bit hard to know. I think part of the difficulty of knowing how a U.S. withdrawal would affect the people in this region is that we don't know exactly who would come in and fill the void. We now have a situation where the U.S. is effectively the protector of about between 25% and 33% of Syria's territory. And you have local groups on the ground who are doing local security and governance and things like that. But you have the Turks to the north who are eyeing this territory. You have the Syrian government to the west who's eyeing this territory. And they've got Russia and Iran working with them, and they're looking at it. You still have jihadists underground. And so in a way, the U.S. is there as a kind of placeholder. And if the U.S. does decide to withdraw, it's very unclear who's going to act first, how they're going to act. So, you know, there's a lot of people in the region worried that if the U.S. does pull out in a very quick way without sort of finding some way to do a handover of these territories, that it could lead to all kinds of other instability. And none of that is going to be good for the displaced.
Ben Hubbard is the Beirut Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Seen through the course of history, nothing is done when you sit back and be silent. So I think this is just the great opportunity to take this time and say that we have voices and we're not happy with how things are going.
The ability to control your body and control your life is the most basic definition of freedom that I can think of.
The idea of the Women's March was unity and standing together.
We, all of us together as one.
So my sign says, I am no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I am changing the things that I cannot accept.
I'm a supporter of love. And I pray that Trump has a successful presidency for all of us.
That's why we keep coming, and that's why we keep trying to do stuff to open up people's eyes.
Well, I hope we send a message to the White House that we are power in numbers. We are great in numbers. And they need to listen to what we have to say.
I did it in my 20s. Now I'm doing it in my 60s.
Sounds from the first Women's March the day after President Trump's inauguration. At least 500,000 women marched down Pennsylvania Avenue that day, and millions participated in marches around the world, chanting for reproductive and civil rights. It felt like the beginning of a movement. 2 years later, with the third march set for this weekend, the scene looks a little different. The organization behind the National Women's March has faced criticism of its leaders for anti-Semitic comments and has lost support from important allies. And far fewer women are expected to march this year. Koa Beck is an author and journalist who's been covering gender issues for a decade. And she says that what we're seeing today isn't so out of line with the past.
There is a history of women from different identities coming together under a feminist umbrella, which is very big and very large and a very large tent, and disagreeing. I mean, there are a number of women I'm thinking of when Gloria Steinem was organizing, and in her conversations with Betty Friedan, I mean, she basically, Betty Friedan alleged that lesbians weren't women and therefore were not, you know, should be in their corner, or they should not be fighting for their rights. Suffragettes definitely didn't think that black women were women, and didn't include them in marches, and actually thought it would detract from their issues if they had black women included in that. And there are versions of that that keep echoing, even I would say within queer rights as well.
Maybe this is just, you know, different factions realizing that, you know what, we've got different goals. I mean, that was something that mm-hmm. came out of the Women's March 3 years ago, which mm-hmm. was, you know, there were women of color there. I was very surprised to see the levels of diversity that were in the crowd, mm-hmm. the numbers of different people that were in the crowd. But then after that, you started seeing, you know,
this recognition once again that, well, you know what? Are these white women in particular going mm-hmm. to show up for issues that affect women of color, right? Mm-hmm. Are we all bound by this one sort of feminist cry, mm-hmm. which I think we were initially maybe, you know, given the political climate of the time. Mm-hmm. Now I think the real issues have reemerged almost, mm-hmm. right? Like, where do women of color, black women, you know, Muslim women fit into this broader narrative?
Well, I think with voting blocs, you see this a lot more cleanly. And in voting blocs, you know, we're getting away from the optics, right? Of like who's on stage and who's speaking and who's speaking on behalf of, you know, a big organization or a corporation or a hashtag. I mean, there's that really famous image that I really love with, you know, from Women's March of two women of color, they're black, holding a sign that says like white women voted for Trump. And then they're just in a sea of white ladies who are like looking at their phones and on like, you know, wearing pink pussy hats and stuff. Traditionally speaking in this country, white women as a voting bloc do not vote for immigration reform, queer rights, criminal justice reform. These are not things that they prioritize when they go to vote. Black women, Latinx, Jewish women, they do. And I think there's a recognition there for, I think, what you're getting to about the structure in which we operate. The really sinister thing that is often not said in mainstream feminist circles is that white women benefit from patriarchy. And women of color, queer women, I mean, they're very aware of the fact that this, while gender is such a big part of this, white women, because of the way our society is structured, are able to get closer to a lot of those patriarchal ideas. I mean, look at Lean In.
Is there any positive that we've seen come out of this movement in the past 3 years? And I don't want to say any positive. I mean, obviously, sure. There's some good. We are talking about feminism today. I remember mm-hmm. the dark days of the 90s when you sure. couldn't talk about it, right? Is there anything that we can sort of latch on to? Because I'll be honest, I do not see anybody on my social media feed talking about going to the Women's March.
Yeah, me either.
No one.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the things that I think with my background and my career, that specifically on gender and race, that I think is dangerous about when political activity or activism becomes trendy. Because if we're falling into that binary, then it's in and it's out. I've worked in media for 10 years, and that's the construction. Things come in, and they're very hot and buzzy, and then they're passe. And it's, you know, and then we're back to the pendulum swinging of the 90s, in which, you know, you don't identify as feminist, or that's considered a taboo thing to say, or you're not supposed to talk about abortion or anything like that.
I mean, the only things that seem to come in and out like that, though, are race and gender. And wealth, but, you
and
know,
wealth, yeah.
Yeah, I do think that, I'm just wondering if that was the moment, that was really it, the moment, you know, at the big march a couple years ago. And now, you know, it's evolved, and I don't think we're going to see the same level of excitement for this march.
I will say, as like, to think about it in terms of like good things, I think there have been documented and reported many, you know, problems and issues with Women's March that I think are fair. I think in terms of activating a large population and spawning many, many marches throughout the country, I think that's a good thing, and just registering political activism as something big and something that you can identify that isn't, especially for younger people, that are not just archival images. I remember when I was starting my career and reporting a lot, I used to really have a lot of romanticism about, you know, civil rights photos and demonstrations and women marching and that sort of thing. But it became harder for me in my career to find images of that were not from the 60s and 70s and even through the like early 80s. So I think in terms of like updating that archive, that's really important for people to see. But I also think that what this is prompting is that the structure by which we think about political activism is often flawed, because we live in a capitalist country. And so in order to spearhead a message about equality, it has to like fit into this box of like hashtag, a metaphoric tote bag, and this sort of feminism that has to exist in a commodified way. This is not the first time this has happened. There are so many sayings about, you know, whatever you value will ultimately be sold back to you. And I think that feminism, race, gender, Women's March is no exception.
I always say it's not a fad. Coa Beck is a journalist and incoming Harvard Kennedy School fellow. Coa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Two years after the first Women's March, do you think the message behind the march is still urgent in 2019?
Hello, this is Lauren from Ravenna, Ohio. I am a white woman, a small business owner, and a self-proclaimed staunch feminist. The women's marches, I feel, are for entitled, straight, white women who the majority, and not all, don't even understand the hardships that minority women, let alone trans and LGBT women, face on a daily basis. I have never, do I plan on ever, participating in such a display of privilege.
Hi, my name is Breeland. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia. I think the message of the Women's March is just as urgent as ever, but as someone who attended the march in both 2017 and 2018, it has been hard to get excited about this year's march amidst news of a lot of turmoil within the Women's March organization. They've faced a lot of criticism for excluding different groups of women and different beliefs of different groups of women, and they've had to issue a lot of statements, and it has sort of been distracting from the unifying message of the march, and so therefore I don't plan on participating this year.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for talking with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.